I'm so excited to share with you that the doors are officially open for my first ever phone-free event that's happening in Los Angeles, California on February 28th at Mudwater Gather in Santa Monica, with the option for you to dive even deeper on March 1st. Now look, this event is about you. It's about you building connections and community and us all really bringing this analog revolution to life and reminding our hearts and souls what we truly crave most, what nourishes our being, which is co-regulating with other humans, having our mirror neurons dance together, sharing experiences together, but also learning together. So on top of all the community and connection possibilities for you, there's also an incredible lineup of speakers. I've got internationally renowned nervous system expert Sarah Baldwin, Nike master trainer Brandon Collingsworth talking about purpose and meaning, and Mandy Balak, who's the president of the Gathering Festival, which is one of the largest marketing and branding conferences in North America. So we're going to be diving deeper into what does the future look like to walk alongside technology and use technology as a tool. Now look, if you want to dive even deeper, there's limited space for a VIP dinner on the Saturday night. And if you want to go even deeper, if it's aligned for leaders, coaches, therapists, entrepreneurs, branding, marketing, whoever is called, there's a mastermind on the Sunday morning with even more limited seating. And that's going to be about what does the future look like to create in this world with technology. So if this sounds like something you're interested in, you want to find out more and save your spot, go to markgroves.com/future. I can't wait to see you there.
Any spiritual practice, you know, meditation, yoga, like all of these practices, the fruit is not in the perfect sun salutation or the perfect, like, spacious open mind of Vipassana. The fruit is in the struggle, you know, the fruit is in making yourself sit down on that cushion, step onto the mat, sit in front of the easel, whatever it is that we need to do, and get to work.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mark Groves Podcast. Today, I am joined by the brilliant artist, Autumn Sky. Welcome.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having me.
Is that your artist name?
That is my artist name and it's my real name. You can check my passport if you want. But I grew up as Sky.
That name's so good. I'm like, I can't. It's got to be like a pen name, you know?
My mom gets all the credit for that. People are like, wow, she knew you.
Seriously.
But I did grow up as Sky. So casually, most people still call me Sky. Autumn is my first name. And now professionally, I use them both. And I don't really have a preference. So you
Works
can just alternate
perfectly.
And call me
well,
whatever
you go
you want.
By either.
Yep, either one's fine.
I discovered your art far before I discovered you. Like in that someone had sent me I forget what it's called, but it's the older woman with the tree behind.
Forgotten Elders.
Yeah, which is my favorite piece, which I now own. And it is just so incredible. And when I found your art, it was probably about 3 years ago. And my wife and I were just like nerding out on it because we were just so captivated by, we didn't understand the sort of deeper undertones of it. Of the feeling I got was just sort of this, let's see if I could be an art interpreter. But I really got this sense of connectedness to nature, remembrance, depth, humanity. Like, just this, it felt really a lot like you're capturing the mystical and the 3D. Is that fair?
That's beautiful. Beautifully put, yeah.
And just so moved by it. And I'm curious, where did it even begin for you?
Well, each time I sit down in front of my canvas, it begins again. It's always a new journey. It takes me in so many different directions and teaches me so much about myself and the creative process and humanity and being in this human form. It's always been my constant. So since I was a child, it's just been my near obsession.
Drawing and painting.
My mom would say, go outside, it's beautiful out. And so I'd gather up all my art supplies and I'd go outside.
Because you grew up in the West Coast?
I was born in Nova Scotia.
Oh, the East Coast.
East Coast. And then spent time all across Canada. I lived in Ontario. And then my mom and stepdad moved to the Sunshine Coast of BC when I was in high school.
What inspired you to start creating art as a kid, even? Like, how did you know that was going to, or like your medium of expression?
It was just a knowing. It was, and it was something that was always encouraged in my family. So my greatest gift is that I was never told not to make art. It was just always sort of accepted, known, encouraged that that's what I was here to do. And before I even knew the concept of when I grow up, I want to be an artist, I knew what I was here to do. There was never sort of a separation or a goal of like one day I will be that thing. It was just, I'm here. Time to get to work. And that's still what gets me out of bed in the morning is like, get to work. It's been this like deep knowing drive that just makes me focus, makes me zero in and just really do my best to show up and then to get out of the way and let these images through that call to be birthed.
Do they start out done in your head?
Sometimes more than others, but never completely done. I really, I don't do commissions for that reason. It's because I can't start with all the answers. I don't have all the answers. If I can remain in play and in dance with inspiration in real time, that's when the magic happens. And I think that that's what people genuinely connect with, is an authentic presence of showing up and surrendering. That people can relate to because it's vulnerable. It's, things change. It takes me on a journey and sometimes there's surprises and sometimes there's sacrifices. And sometimes I work on something that needs to be painted over or new ideas come in that feel risky or strange or obscure and they all make sense in the end. And so just really learning to listen to my body, learning to listen to my heart and being able to listen to the inspiration as it flows. I think that that's what creates presence that other people connect with. I don't think it's purely the image. It's more like you were saying you weren't sure how to put it into words. I don't necessarily know how to put it into words either, but I know what it feels like. And so just being really alive to that and being really patient with that and listening is, and sometimes I just start with the seed of an idea and it takes me on a journey and surprises come along the way.
Do they all have different times that they take?
Oh yeah. Sometimes they feel like they paint themselves. They come and just explode out of me. The idea comes, I start that canvas that same day and then it just pours out in a matter of a few days. And other times they're a slog. They are just a meditation and devotion and continuous showing up. I usually have a few pieces working at the same time as well.
Yeah.
So I really trust the compass of my attention and inspiration and my heart to show me which one needs to be worked on at that time. But I just this week finished one that I have probably well over 500 hours in, and I started in September and it's definitely a meditation. There's a lot of detail.
500 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. What was at the basis of the piece of work, Forgotten Elders?
That piece I started during the Ferry Creek blockades. And just so much of, especially the local, but the larger community was really turning our attention towards these old growth forests, these mm-hmm. cathedrals, you know, these ancient sacred places that were being cut down. And so I wanted to do my part as art as activism and speak to that, but with more of an energy and sensitivity of, I don't feel like my place is necessarily picket lines and chaining myself to trees. I bow deeply to those people.
Yeah.
But where I feel like my biggest effect can be is in my studio. And so I wanted to just really support and meditate and focus my gratitude in on those trees. And so that's where it started. And creating the original was with gold leaf. So it has this this large tree with all the tree rings around her head acting as a halo.
Mm.
So it's this elder, sort of androgynous elder that has this tree halo speaking to the holiness of the trees and the spirit of the forest. And in the cloak of the figure is the forest, the misty West Coast rainforest.
Mm.
And just really meditating on the concept of these trees being our elders, being our, even our priests or our sacred beings, being our cathedrals and our holy places. And just like the water is ancient and timeless and the mountains are ancient and timeless, these trees are, they've stood for a century, many of them or more.
Yeah, some of them hundreds of years, right?
Oh, yeah.
Thousands. Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's just knowing that they have seen so much more than we have seen. Like some of those trees were standing before the Great Pyramids were built.
Isn't that crazy to think about? And like that we're just so quick to chop them. And, oh, they'll grow back.
Oh, the technology's gotten so good too that they can just be chopped down so fast.
Yeah, and just turned into whatever they get turned into, which, don't get me wrong, like I can see obviously how resources contribute to changing things and building things. And
yeah, we need wood.
Right.
I love wood.
Right. And at the same time, can we hold that we need to still honor some places as sacred? You know, when I think about going into churches, you know, I grew up Catholic, and so my relationship to the church isn't exactly like, oh, I love those places. But there are churches that I've been in that I'm like, wow, this is art. This is a cathedral, you know, in its literal definition. But then I drive through Cathedral Grove on the way to Tofino or just along the West Coast. And there's a body of felt sense that is just regulation, nervous system, calm, being held. Although I don't want to minimize that can be an experience of being in community in a building. It seems odd that we need research that shows that forest bathing is good for you. And if anything, it's, you know, if someone has anxiety or is depressed or is navigating challenges, one of the greatest prescriptions is go to nature, go to the desert, go somewhere that is like being reminded that it's not all supposed to be so like worried about your likes and your algorithms. And I think about the relationship of social media to art because of course it allows art to be distributed. And at the same time, there's a lot of art that never gets made now because the artist doesn't believe it will be validated.
Right.
Which I think, what do you think about that, you know, as an artist?
Yeah, or our attention is being captured and captivated by these little glowing boxes. Sometimes I sit there, I'm like working on my phone, working, quote unquote, on my phone, which is so distractible, right? It's always under the justification of, oh, I just have to do that thing for work. But then we get distracted by all the things that million different directions that can distract us.
Let me check this.
Memes and jokes. And
memes are great. Like the internet is brilliant and
it's
savage
brilliant.
And all the things.
It gives us so much inspiration. It connects us. You know, that's how we connected. It connects us to a greater community and belonging. But it's sometimes, you know, an hour will go by and I realize, wow, I could have gotten so much painting done in that hour. It's such a dance and delicate balance of how much time we allow ourselves to spend on anything, really. We can let ourselves dissolve into a sunset, into playing with our dogs or our children, or we can let it be dissolved by social media or by art. I sit in front of my canvas sometimes for 12 or 15 hours in a day, and it really, it's like, I think I'm so busy. I have this concept that I'm so busy, you know, the laundry piles up, my emails pile up because I'm dedicating all of this time. And sometimes I think, wow, how much would I get done if I didn't paint for that many hours a day? It's not always that much, but it's usually a lot. And how much would I get done otherwise? But it's not like this trading thing. Our culture has cultivated this concept of time is money. And so we're always trying to like commodify our time. And then, you know, you allow yourself to scroll for half an hour or an hour or watching a show that's not enriching your life because it's just entertainment, and think, oh gosh, I've just wasted this money, this time. I could have been productive. And so I meditate on that a lot. I don't necessarily have any clear answer of, you know, of whether we should, you know, regulate. Some people work really well with rules and structure and routines. I I'm very, very led by my heart and my attention and my, my sort of whims, my creative compass. And so I need to also just accept that sometimes it's intake and sometimes it's output. And as an artist, it's very tricky. My business relies heavily on social media.
Right. Same. Yeah.
Right. So there's all these, and then these algorithms are just like, I don't understand them. They're always changing anyways. Even if I did understand them, one moment they're changing. And so I don't play the game. I get messages a lot from other artists saying, how did you build your audience? And to me, I'm like, I just feel like I'm still just starting. Like I haven't even cracked into a larger audience yet. It's been very organic and I don't have any tricks other than just post when I'm inspired. I don't really follow timelines of ideal time. And I'm like just starting to get into videos, but I don't really do lives or many reels or anything. So I feel like I could optimize it, but then that mind that says, oh, we should optimize it. I just wonder about that too. I'm like, well, I don't necessarily want to spend more time on my phone. I want to paint.
Right, right. It's such an interesting balance because it's like being able to be with the truth that we live in a productivity / time commoditizing world, that to opt out of, you have to have commoditized your time significantly. You know, for the most part, I don't want to negate, because I can hear someone like David Goggins yelling at me right now, like, you got time, motherfucker, you know, but there is a grief in that we like have been born into. If we were born, you know, 300-400 years ago, 500-700, you know, we might be born into a different role of productivity within our village, but there still was a lot of ritual that was just part of the practices of the tribe, the village, the ceremony, all that kind of stuff. And I feel in a lot of ways like your art seems to be this intersection of nature with humanity, with animals. Is that is there a conscious intention to that, or do they come to you in dreams? Like how is that even an accurate observation in your experience?
Yeah, they come a lot of different ways. Sometimes they come while I'm driving, or they come in conversation. They come when I'm walking in the woods, or when I'm working on other pieces is actually a lot of when my ideas sort of flow into me. I feel like the creative channel, when it's opened in action of some other medium, that's when the idea pours in. The ideas just start to bubble up and through. I don't think that inspiration really is super pumped on somebody sitting cross-armed, staring at a blank canvas and grumbling why we're not inspired.
Yeah,
I think that inspiration delights in people that are in action and are in that dance of creativity and process. And so I keep a sketchbook close by and I take notes while I'm working, and ideas come as I'm working on other pieces. And the animals, they have their own voices, and they just, it's never any one thing.
Yeah.
But the animals are a strong presence, and the nature in general, and our relationship to nature, our relationship to ourselves. So my art sort of covers these themes of relationship to self, relationship to other, relationship to nature, relationship to the cosmos.
Yeah.
And how all of those relationships dance and intersect. And the concept of nature as outside of us is a theme that I like to challenge in my art, because I believe that we are a part of nature, not apart from it. And so if we can accept that we are part of nature, then we can start to understand how we relate to our own bodies and our own health, and how we relate to the health of the ecosystem, and how we relate to the planet as a whole and each other. You know, this idea of we are each other, our perception is limited by our head, mainly. Most of our senses sort of concentrate in our skull. So we think that we are in our head. And so my art, I try to really like encourage the contemplation of extending the barrier of ourselves past our head, past our bodies, and out into each other, out into the sunshine and into the birds and into the trees and into the water, especially. The water's always flowing in and out of us.
Right.
And so how can we relate to the water in a new way that can help us recognize our own eternal nature? Spirit and water have so much in common, I feel like. Spirit is always just taking new shape.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you believe that there is life after death in some form, or consciousness or spirit or energy after death, a great place to put your contemplation about that concept is in water, because water is always changing shape, but it's still water molecules, and it's been water molecules since the beginning of time. You know, maybe it was hurling through space on a frozen ball or however it came into being, but water molecules aren't just made and destroyed. They're the same. No matter how poisoned some water is, those water molecules are still pure, just like our spirit. No matter how many stories we have compiling in our consciousness and all of the hopes and pressures and fears and demands that we put on ourselves, our spirit is still that pure essence. And so I like to show these mirrors. I really believe that paintings are mirrors. And I like to show that relationship to self, to spirit, to other, to nature, and try to remind us all, myself as I'm painting,
mm-hmm.
and people that witness these paintings, just remind each other of that purity, of that beauty and timelessness.
To awaken that recognition. Yeah. It seems to be the arrogance of human consciousness that we believe we're separate from. But it's interesting because everything you're saying, like the ability to be at peace with our own mortality is to accept our mortality. Sorry, that I think is actually, everyone's going to die, and that's just a fact. But it's like what brings peace to the recognition that you are going to transform into nothing is one belief, right? Mm-hmm. Or into a place like hell or heaven. And someone outside of you gets to be the broker of that. Mm-hmm. That's another belief. And, or you're part of everything. And when you change form, you're still part of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help but believe that, or feel, although that I think is something that I'm always like navigating and negotiating and remembering, that there's so much more peacefulness to that.
Hmm.
Like when I was a kid, you know, as a Catholic, you're taught like if you're bad, you go to hell. And if you're good, you go to heaven. And some other dude gets to just like is telling me what the rules are. And I remember, I think it's Alan Watts who said that it was the most brilliant move of the church to become the broker between you and God.
Oh.
And to be able to like shape behavior, to shape virtue, morality, mm-hmm. right? And
just
I think
funnel some money.
Right. Just if you donate enough, though, you're
tithe.
Good.
I and used to tithe 70 cents a week.
That was your tithing?
Yeah, that was my 10% of my $7.
to like, go to heaven.
70
to go
cents.
You're right. That was a lot back then.
It's a lot.
Yeah. In the 90s, you could buy a house with 70 cents. Now, sorry, Gen Z, effed. Yeah, I mean, I joke about that, but that's not funny because, you know, it's like our time, our tying to home.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? Maybe it's because of the algorithm or the recognition of my own thoughts and then seeing those thoughts in other people, is that there does seem to be a real longing for the forest, a longing for nature, a longing mm-hmm. for community. You see a lot of memes that are like, oh, my dream is to buy a farm with friends and move to community, right?
Yeah.
And you're like, to me, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, it makes me a little like teary just thinking about like the sort of the common longing for that. I think it's really understandable. I think so much of what that is too is like the longing for slowness and savoring and like stretching time. Time is going so fast. You know, you don't even notice if you scroll for an hour.
Yeah, it's where if you're very present without technology, an hour feels like for fucking ever.
Oh, yeah. I remember my mom, when I was probably like 5, my mom left me and my sister with a friend who we were staying with. So, you know, she's like, okay, I'll be back in an hour. And I remember just thinking like, oh my God, an hour is forever.
Yeah, yeah.
It's forever. And now, You know, we will pour 30 hours into some TV series that we don't even care about. And it's just...
And it'll take you on an emotional roller coaster, like Handmaid's Tale. Good God.
Oh, I had to stop. That was way too close.
Yeah, that one's hard. It was too close during COVID. You're like, what's happening here?
Yeah, that's when I started to try it. Oof,
like,
no.
you need to escape Canada. Don't come here.
Yeah, I think of media as like we're consuming it, right?
Yeah.
You can eat the worst food. Like you can eat the worst hamburger you could possibly find, just made of garbage. And you can eat that. It'll be through your system in, you know, you could say 24 hours probably. There's going to be some residue. But like for the most part, it's going to be out of you in 24 hours. You consume one piece of media. It doesn't matter how short or long it is. It never leaves your system. We're still haunted by the horror movies we watched as teenagers. Like, why are we still...
I can remember a scene of The Exorcist, for sure.
Yeah, or, like, Scary Movie, or Scary Movie was comedy, but, like, Scream and those, like, movies that we teenagers love that. And I used to, like, rebelling against parents. And,
Saw.
Yeah.
Saw series.
I can't. But now, like, I don't want to be afraid to be in the forest by myself or to walk up the stairs in the dark. I don't think that those sort of unnerving thoughts and the imagination of that, I don't think that that's natural. I think that that's residue of consumption as a child, or some people watch it. And, you know, the studies that they've done of like showing somebody a red apple and mapping the brain, all the synopsis, and then say, okay, close your eyes and picture a red apple, and then mapping the brain. And it's the same.
Right.
Our brain has the same map for reality and imagination. So when we're watching a movie, and we fall in love with someone in the movie and then they die and we are crying, we are literally grieving that person. Or when we are afraid for our life in that movie, the things that it's doing to our nervous system, I don't even think we understand.
I don't think we do either, especially what rapid form content does to us. Mm. You know, this is a very delicate topic, but the word neurodivergence I find very fascinating, because it insinuates that if someone is neurodivergent, they're not a normal thinker. But if I was to ask most people if they are a normal thinker, they'll say they're not.
I'm anything but normal.
And so, So then what is normal, right? Because that ultimately has to have the definition. But if we're going to say that everyone has a unique lens of the world, which I think is true, then everyone's divergent from each other. But when we select it as a self perception, which I'm not minimizing actual neurological differences in people, of course. Mm-hmm. So that's why this comes with no negation of your experience. Mm-hmm. But I think it's important to explore language and how language positions identity, because if I identify as neurodivergent, which you're welcome to, but it actually is a way of sourcing power, and also I'm a victim of another thing, then it actually starts to be a way that I want to be more special again. But then I'm still looking for other people in a way for me to separate my specialness from connection, right?
Yeah.
So there's this strange paradox that we have to hold, that one, our specialness that we sought from our mother, probably mainly, and our father, but then belonging in community, it has to occur within first. It's helpful if someone outside of you validates that you're worthy of love and belonging, but if you don't actually believe that, you'll still be seeking it through these other ways. And I just think about how it becomes like a form of narcissism, which I think we live in this world that is very much like self-obsessed. And I recognize the whole irony that I have an Instagram with my name on it and a podcast with my name on it, right? Like, this is not the I'm special and I live in a different place and I'm on a pedestal saying everyone's doing this, I'm not. But it's this reflection that I've been having about how media is shaped. How can we not have low attention spans? How can we not have ADHD? Like, when people tell me they have ADD or ADHD, I'm like, welcome to being in the world today. But then I have this longing, because I grew up in the 90s and the 80s, and that was I was born in 78. And I remember a childhood when there was no technology. I remember going to a friend's house. I remember your parents being like, okay, I hope we see you later. Like, you could call on a landline, you know, but it might be busy.
Yeah.
Or you get call waiting or whatever, but
you're just swimming in the Kicking Horse River and flattening pennies like, on the train tracks.
Hope
it's okay.
Hope you don't derail a train and good luck drinking out of the hose. Hope you don't die. You know, like I just think of when I went to Peru, we didn't have technology for the week. That was in the Amazon. And the evenings and the days spent connecting with no technology, we were just all together, the group. And I did psychedelics while I was there. But I would say the most profound experience for me was actually that.
Mm.
Was this like, oh, this is how healing occurs.
Slow time down? Did it feel longer?
Yeah, that week was forever,
yeah.
You know, but at the same time, yeah, when time is being commoditized, then how can you be present to it? Because you're actually being extracted from.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Like, how long does it take to wait for a ferry or a bus if your phone's out of batteries?
Yeah, and in a way, we're like, how
time.
Do we meet people? It's
yeah.
like, well, if your head's in your goddamn phone, mm-hmm. how can you?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, can we actually just become more present? Which I think, you know, coming back to art, it's like, art can remind us of this separation, remind us of like what your pieces do is like they evoke something. And for everyone, I'm sure my experience of one of your pieces of art will be different than someone else's.
Yeah.
But it's like what's moving through your expression is meant to meet people's experience, which I love how you said it's like you wake up every morning and there's an integrity associated with your creation. Like this is why I'm here. When I was in my late 20s and it was like the birth of the desire to learn about relationships, which that's the thing is you never know what's going to bring you towards whatever you're born here to at least begin to do when you start it. Which I think what's so beautiful about having parents who have maybe pursued their own passions, artists, they're very open to the art moving through a child.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up thinking I needed to be an accountant, a doctor, and that's not any of my parents' fault, but it was like they grew up with nothing. So it's like these are the people who have stuff. And then when I went to go, I bought this loft and I wanted a wall unit for it. And I saw one that I really liked at Restoration Hardware. And it was like pipes and wood. And I saw the price and I was like, I guess we're not getting that. But then I was like, man, I wonder, you could probably just build something like this with like plumbing pipe. So I looked it up on the internet and I built one.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was building it, I unlocked something in myself that I didn't know I had, like creativity. Cause I always thought creativity you can't make money. You can't survive doing it. It makes no sense. I'm not a creative person,
mm-hmm.
but it was actually like such a window into my writing and cause I was like, wait, I am a writer. I am this. I am that. What do you think for people who are feeling called to bring some form of art to the world? As someone who has been an artist your whole life, what would you say to them?
Well, the fact that I was always encouraged to make art and never told not to, I don't take for granted, not for a second. And I'm grateful for it every day because I know it was rare. And so part of my mission in the world is I also teach art. I host retreats and really try to take people on a journey of creative discovery and creative empowerment and try to be that cheerleader to them that they might never have had.
Mm-hmm.
We can really easily internalize the voices from our childhood or from our lives that tell us that we're not good enough or that we don't have any talent or that that's a waste of time or to get a real job. All the different ways that we're told not to make art. There's a million different ways. And they are loud and constant, but we internalize them and then we think that they're our voice. And so I've talked to people so often and say, oh, are you an artist? And they say, oh, no, I'm not an artist. I mean, I love to paint. I love to draw. I love to write, but I'm not an artist. To me, artist is not, it's not a noun. It's a way of being. It's a way of, it's an action. So if you are creating art, you are an artist. It's not some badge. You don't need to graduate from anything in order to be an artist.
You don't need like a blue check on,
No, you don't need to be verified.
Yeah, right.
You don't need a degree.
Yeah.
You don't need to be peer reviewed or anything like that. You just need to be in creative flow. And even if that creative flow is not paint to canvas or hammer to nail to wood or food to skillet, you know, whatever way you feel a creative spark in you to move towards. Maybe it's drawing in the sand when you're at the beach with your kids. Maybe it's making a necklace out of some beads of a bracelet that broke. Or maybe it's dancing. Maybe it's singing in the car but when you're by yourself. It doesn't really matter what that creative process is. What matters is that you give yourself permission to relax into it and play. Because it's the act of doing that will train us to trust and surrender in creative flow. So it's not like you need to come to a canvas, buy a beautiful, big, shiny, white, pristine canvas and throw some paint at it to unlock your creative potential as a spontaneous painter. Sometimes that spontaneity can only come, you know, if you only have 10 minutes to dance in your bedroom before you leave for your serving job and you just dance or you put your headphones on or you like write some poetry or make a beautiful meal for your family. But just being curious in the creative flow will teach you that that curiosity and faith is totally safe. You're safe in it. It's not going to end the world. It's not going to get you in trouble. It's not going to waste money. Creating for the sake of creating with play and curiosity and joy and reverence of like attention and savoring. What is that crayon that you just took from your kid's crayon box? What does that feel like as you drag it across a piece of cardboard that you pulled out of the recycle?
Right.
It doesn't need to be some perfect thing that you're going to save forever. It doesn't need to be Instagrammable. It can just be something that you make and then throw in the fire, or something that you make and then feed to your family. It can be spontaneous and it can be momentary. But every time we do that, we train our body, our heart, our nervous system, and our imagination to relax into the creative process a little bit more. And it might take a lot of those acts to be able to fully surrender into being that person on the dance floor who's fully trusting their body. And, you know, right. Everybody looks at it and be like, wow,
I'm like, go.
Yeah. Like there's part of us that's sort of embarrassed, but part of us is like, oh, we long for that.
Right. Right.
It's beautiful.
Or we judge it.
We judge it because we want to be
it.
Yeah,
so, exactly.
Or the person who makes a spontaneous painting that's just abstract and just dripping and smeared colors and like, you know, part of me longs to be able to keep a painting like that, but I want to get in there and fix everything and make it all, you know, I have my own, the style that comes through me is very perfectionist oriented. So I have my own journey through that, but I've learned to really listen to my body in the creative process, to really listen somatically.
Like the call to what needs to be
what
changed,
feels right.
Adjusted,
ideas
created.
Come and I just feel them. And I move towards them. So same with cooking, same with singing, same with whatever it might be.
Even just expression, you know, it's like what you want to post in a reel or like the podcast episode you want to do, the YouTube video. This idea that it needs to be perfect is what always stops people. Mm-hmm. What is it? Perfect is the enemy of good. I forget. There's some sort of saying about that.
Yeah. Perfectionism leads to procrastination.
Yeah, it's such a good excuse. Like there's where I think of, you know,
one day I'll be an artist.
David Goggins, right? Where it's like, no, like start, like get going.
Yeah.
And that's really it is like whenever I'm working with someone who's creating something, just like it was for me, it was like, just start.
Yeah.
It's like, you just got to start because then you're now someone who does that. So your whole identity has to crash. So now you're someone who does that. So now you got to do that. You know, how do you, because I think everything that you're saying is such a metaphor for every aspect of life, which I'm sure isn't, you know, intentional in so many ways. But it's like, how do you allow something that you start to become something different than what you started? Because I think of a lot of like, one of my favorite thoughts that I've had just in a self-awareness reflection was that when I had something I've always dreamt of and I got it and then I didn't want it. And I was like, wait, I had like shame about that. And then when I worked through it, I was like, oh, this is just learning. This is why you get the thing. So you can learn you don't want that thing. And then you adjust. That's how you discover what you want. And I think we have a hard time letting go of relationships or inviting them to change because we're afraid to let them go means that we're discarding it, you know, which that's like such an interesting.
You flip a coin sometimes to feel, to realize what you actually feel, right?
Yeah, isn't that fucked?
It's so weird.
Like if it's heads, I'm in. If it's tails, I'm out. It's like, wait, what?
No.
Do you hope it is? Yeah. Right?
Yeah. And so much of what we imagine of our lives, of our future, of the painting on our easel or whatever it is, the book that we're writing, so much of these creative projects. And yes, absolutely. What you said, the creative act is the living act. It's art has taught me again and again and again how to walk in the world, how I want to walk in the world, how, you know, what goes on for me, the self-talk around perceived mistakes or changing my mind or perfectionism, all of these things. It's such a great teacher. And every time I have retreats and people at the end are always like, whoa, I thought this was just a painting retreat. They're just like all in.
I had to go
like
back and have hard conversations. Yeah.
Well, it's so much of most, it's like hard conversations with ourselves of like, wow, I'm so hard on myself. Or sometimes I'm cut myself too much slack and I don't finish anything. Right? Like, where's your balance point? Balance is not rigidity of like equal parts self-compassion and devotion. Like, it's sometimes it's going to be more attention bit, yeah. And sometimes that's got to be more surrender. It's that like masculine, feminine, in-breath, out-breath. Sometimes we need a little bit more oxygen and sometimes we just need to let go a little bit more. But there's always a rebalancing.
Like any system, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so
it'll find its way, but it's better to listen because when it finds its way, it's usually a massive correction.
Yeah. And when we.
Not a big fan of those, despite my choices I've made in my life. It might look like it. Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes like we build up so much identity around what we think something's supposed to look like. You know, by the time I'm 30, I'm going to be married with a white picket fence, 2.5 kids and a dog. Like that kind of concept. Wait, we make up these ideas
did you know
or this painting. Was that you?
Oh, my God. Yeah. I feel like that was the narrative of the 90s.
And it's probably way better. My life is way better than I could have planned.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that yours is as well because
it is way better.
We've learned through creative process how to surrender and keep showing up at the same time. It's this dance of show up, do the work, get the hell out of the way.
That's interesting. I like that reflection of like surrender and show up. It's not a surrender. The world, the fate will arrive. No. It's like, you know, if you want fate to work for you, you have to work towards it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I remember The Secret is like, just imagine a red bike and you'll get a red bike.
Right.
My brother, who I feel is like the ultimate cynic, was like, you're not going to get a goddamn red bike. You just imagine a red bike. You think it's going to show up on your doorstep?
Well, the part they missed was the emotion, right?
Right.
Was the wind in the sail. Yeah, the rudder might be imagining a red bike. We're sitting in our little boat pointing towards a red bike, but there's no wind in the sail.
Right.
We actually have to take action.
Yes.
What's that? God helps those who help themselves.
Yeah.
I love that idea of like the momentum that is in our life. Like if we have momentum moving us towards despair, towards the worst possible outcome, then we're probably going to move pretty fast towards that. But if we can point ourselves towards what lights us up, and maybe that's taking a big risk. Like sometimes it does call, life calls for that. Art calls for that. The creative process, whether it's living or painting, will call us to make big changes and take big risks. But if it feels right, and that's why I love the concept of like practice with drawing in the sand and dancing in your room and singing in the car, because you'll get to know what feels right in your body.
Back in your body,
yeah. And if it feels right, just move towards that. Sometimes those risks feel scary. And sometimes they're baby steps. You can take little baby steps along the way, but you can really pay attention to how it feels in your body. And as you move towards that, things will come around to support that shift. And it's not to say that you might shift again. Like recently in a painting, I had a concept in mind from the start that I was going to cover the face. Once it was totally finished, I was going to cover the face in a veil because it's all mushrooms. Yeah. So I was going to put this like veiled lady mushroom over top of her face after the freckles, eyelashes, final twinkles, everything. And I did it. I spent hours painting this veil that I'd had months. I'd planned on doing this because it felt right. And then as soon as I was done, I thought, oh, nope. As of this moment, it feels right that that goes away.
So you have to paint your face
again. I painted her face again. But every time I paint a face, I paint it better. You know, it's like there's no wasted time. There's no, like, I didn't die. It's not like this. The painting wasn't destroyed.
And you wouldn't know it if you didn't paint the veil. I had to try it. To know it's not a fit, to make a fit.
There's no edit undo when it comes to traditional media. So I just had to actually act it out and really follow through. It'd be nice. But then I wouldn't have gotten, you know, it's easy to fantasize about, oh, wouldn't that be nice if I could just edit undo? Or what would a painting look like if it was all in red tones? Nope, don't like it. Back to the natural tones. But then I don't get the fruit of the creative process. There is such
all the things that happen.
Precious, precious fruit from struggle.
That's really beautiful. I've never considered traditional media versus, let's say, Adobe or something, right? And AI now, right? Because AI, you're like, can you paint a painting with a blah, blah, blah? And I think it's a really interesting conversation because, you know, we can go there, but it's like this merger of media and technology with consciousness, which in a way, I think the internet is part of conscious, like human consciousness sort of mapped out. Mm-hmm. The shadow side of it, obviously, too, because you can't have one without the other. And what it's allowed us to now know, like now 10 people aren't in charge of all information flow, although they're certainly trying to create dis and misinformation laws, which I'm not saying there's not value to curating information, but who curates it? This is the issue is like, who decides what hate speech is? Who decides, is it just speech you don't personally like or something that's inconvenient? Because that, if we look at history, has been verifiably true in every single part of history with someone who's in power. Mm-hmm. So it's, but when I think about the undo feature of Adobe, let's say, which is incredibly convenient, it really represents, again, more of that, like our inability to be in the mistake, the quote unquote failure, the quote unquote, which we only discover through the experience of painting the veil. Like you only know the value of the face by removing the face. Mm-hmm. You only know it's the right fit. It just like in life, you only know what is the right turn by taking the wrong turn. And yet we think the wrong turn is the evidence of inadequacy or an evidence of failure. Mm-hmm. And yet you don't know right without it. And so I found this when I was in my 30s, I was at this retreat and in it, I did this process where like there was a group of, it was a male and female retreat. It was a psychotherapy training. And I was part of the training was I faced this group of women and apologized for all the ways I disrespected the feminine. Ooh. Yeah, it was deep work, but it was so beautiful. And I could feel them hold not just compassion and accountability and all that kind of thing, but they were all in tears because it was something they'd always wanted to hear. In the like subtle ways, you know, I'm talking about like dancing in the gray of language, like I don't want a relationship, you know, all that kind of stuff. But that I was out of integrity, it just like I was dancing in language. I was dancing in the idea it was of an integrity because I was transparent, quote unquote. But what was so beautiful is I had experienced the rejection of the younger versions of myself. The one that didn't have boundaries when I got cheated on, the one that didn't, I was like, I don't need you. I need someone who's like now unavailable and strict and a wall. Mm. And I remember in a meditation feeling this younger version of me re-enter my body after that experience of this confrontation. And it was like he was welcomed home again. You know what I mean? And so I think when I consider like the painting the thing and then needing, it's like, if you made that a rejection or a failure, then the art isn't the art, just like we aren't the way we are.
Yeah. The impulse for many people in those moments would probably be giving up or destroy it, or, you know, like a moment of rage could come when we make what we might perceive as a mistake. But to be able to, and that's why I really believe in practicing the creative process in whatever way you can, mm-hmm. paying attention to it, it will train us to have faith. And so, you know, any spiritual practice, like, you know, meditation, yoga, like all of these practices, the fruit is not in the perfect sun salutation or the perfect, like, spacious open mind of Vipassana. The fruit is in the struggle.
Yeah.
You know, the fruit is in making yourself sit down on that cushion, step onto the mat, sit in front of the easel, whatever it is that we need to do, and get to work.
Sacred.
And really feel the push and pull so that we can learn about ourselves, we can learn about our self-talk, we can learn about faith in the journey. And that's where the magic happens. That's where the growth happens. And when I repainted that face, it wasn't as big of a deal as I thought it was going to be. You know, I just repainted the face. There goes a day. I could have easily spent that day doing whatever. And so instead, I'm just going to repaint the face. It's going to be better than it was.
Only took you a day. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Well, and then there's tweaking. But whatever. It's like, it's doable. It's achievable.
Yeah.
And I can now look back on that and I can feel the story of it integrating into my body, integrating into my heart, into learned experience and wisdom. And I could share that process. Here we go back to social media. I filmed the painting in time lapse. I filmed the painting of the veil and the painting over the veil back of the face. And then I wrote spontaneously. I just sat and I like dictated this piece of writing around that process of quote unquote mistakes or whatever that part of the process, the struggle of that, and shared it. And it's the most shared and viewed video that I've ever made. So the way that could then ripple out into the world and support other people in their creative purpose and creative process is so much more valuable than my one little annoying
your perfect
hiccup
piece of art
that I had to like, oh, go and repaint something. So being able to, that becomes its own piece of art. That experience becomes its own adventure, time capsule, you know, just perfectly contained within the longer journey of this painting, which is just one painting in my life, that it's just like one little part, one little painting, even though it was a very in-depth painting. It's just, it's not that significant. It's not that big of a deal. It's just colorful mud on a piece of canvas. It's like very trivial when we remember that we're just a tiny speck on a tiny speck hurling through space. Like it's not that big a deal. Yeah. So don't take it so seriously. Get back to work. Follow the heart. And I did that and it shared and it just like hearing people, I won't even know the stories of the ways that could impact. But what I did hear was people reflecting again and again that really helped them on their own process and with their own hiccups and perfectionism. And just, so there we go. It took on its own life just by my willingness to keep showing up.
Yeah. Had you just taken a picture of the final product, very different.
Yeah.
Than the art that was created from the filming, which is its own, as you said, its own thing. Mm-hmm. The writing, the expression of the process. Now people are seeing themselves in the story, not just the outcome. Mm-hmm. But then to know that there was a veil on the face before, and now here's the finished piece. Yeah. I mean, that no one would have known that.
No.
Just like we don't know, you know, we think that someone gets lucky when they create or they become famous or popular or successful. Like I, in the comments recently, someone said, well, Mark's really found success because he got lucky. And I was like, shit, you know, I posted it every day, not missing a day, sometimes three times a day for 8 years. You know, I took a month off because I thought I was going to have a psychotic break, you know, and it's like, I don't care that someone writes that. I just think it's interesting that we like to look at someone's experience and just, if we haven't followed a journey, we just see what's there now, which is why I've been, and I know you are too, but I've always been so transparent in my actual process because no one is ever a finished project or product. And even this idea that like this moment right now is the moment we're in, but in a week, you and I will be different on a cellular level. That's true. But psychologically, emotionally, also, you know, coming back to what you said about media, my wife now, you know, we have an 11-month-old and she's like, there'll be no listening to this type of music around, you know, or whatever, some of my 90s rap.
No 90s hip hop? Yeah, come on.
Some of it. End of the Road, Song for Mama, we're good with Boys to Men. But I used to joke about it when she would say it before we had a son. But I actually see how important it is, the stuff we consume. Because during the public health stuff going on the last 3 years, it's like, and if I watched anything that was dysregulating, like I tried to watch John Wick 3, which I do really like those stories because they're retribution, you know, they're good. It's like Shooter, the movie with Mark Wahlberg is so good. But I couldn't watch them. I had to, but so grateful I did. I watched Ted Lasso, which like your nervous system's
I'm a
like,
better person now.
Oh my God, Ted, like we just want you to be happy. And the movie Shrink, or the television show, I think it's called Shrinking. Yeah. Shrink. Yeah. The one with Jason, I forget his name, but it's really good. It's like light and Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
And I found that I had to go to comedy.
Yeah.
You know? So it's like, it's so important what we consume. And coming back to what you said, is like the way you treat it is this sacred act. Mm-hmm. And we're all worthy of treating what is trying to move through us as sacred. And in a way, I feel like that's the remembering that art can show us. Mm-hmm. We can experience the imperfections, the things. But also at some point, you know, I think I love how Elizabeth Gilbert says, like, you get an inspiration, and if you don't take it, someone else will get it. Mm-hmm. I really think about that. It's like, if I don't jump on this, someone else is going to create the exact same thing I'm trying to create. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But through their own unique channel.
Yeah.
So, and sometimes that happens. I've painted paintings and simultaneously without knowing, another artist friend creates the same painting, but in their unique way. And then we show up. One time we showed up to a show in LA with our two paintings, and they were literally the same painting, but slightly different. That one was about pregnancy. Mine was about art as birthing.
Wow.
And so, but it was the same position, like same position of the body, same colors, same composition, same size relatively of painting. It was so fascinating.
Were you both just like, do we just become best friends and competitors?
Nah. Well, it's that's the thing is I think that in any art, I don't believe in competition in that way. Like, yeah, there's only so many dollars in the bank account or hours in the day. So there is some scarcity to attention.
Of course.
And investment. But for the most part, the more art in the world, the more art there is in the world, which is a wonderful thing. And the more artists there are, the more people realize their own creative potential and how that ripples out into the world. We remember, like you say, that the sacredness of showing up and being in dedication and practice, and also the playfulness. Like, don't take it so seriously. Like you're saying to watching comedy, and I totally relate to that. I love to laugh. I love to like live in the paradox of prayer and playfulness because that to me is where the juice lies, is in like really paying attention, the savoring and really being in service to the divine, and then being silly and dancing around to ridiculous music. And, you know, I have a very large collection of dad jokes.
Oh, wow.
Which is sacred.
I'll have to get some of those. Yeah. I told Kai that I'm too funny to have dad jokes. Oh. She was like, that's funny. It's supposed to be funny. I'm like, it is funny. That's, come on.
Well, I tell a lot of dad jokes. I'm obviously not a dad. Do you know what you call somebody who tells dad jokes who's not a father?
What?
A faux pas.
That's pretty good. That's really good. You have to know French to do that one.
Yeah.
That's really good. I'm curious, for people who are listening or watching, where can they find more of like the how you take people through the creative process, and just more of, first off, everybody go check out Autumn Skies art. Like, it's honestly, it's so moving and so beautiful. And I feel like you're for sure one of my favorite artists of this time. And I think you're doing really beautiful work and translating things that there's like words will not captivate the experience. And where can people find more of all the things?
You can find me on Instagram, Etsy, and my website are all Autumn Sky Art. Also Facebook art page. So Sky with an E, SKYE. And just find me there. And on my website, you can connect in through the events section to the retreats, upcoming teaching retreats, which we host on my husband and I's beautiful property on the Sunshine Coast, Heartwood.
So
we host there a few times a year. And I'll be teaching in Italy in September as well. I usually teach an international retreat per year. So that's really sweet. I did Hollyhock last year. Not so international, but a different island.
It's on Cortez, right?
Cortez, yeah. Yeah. Beautiful. And then on the media section, you can see videos and podcasts and various ways that I pontificate. And
That is the an apt word, pontification. Is there anything that, you know, for the people listening who are really stepping into their creative endeavors or are artists, is there anything that you want to share with them that we haven't shared?
Do it. Yeah, just really remembering that in-breath, out-breath, remembering that dance of left brain, right brain, masculine, feminine, however that embodies in you in your unique way. Remembering the very sweet, somewhat paradoxical balance point of showing up and surrendering simultaneously, and find where your own unique place is on that scale. And maybe that's going to change throughout the day. Maybe it's going to change throughout the creative project or throughout your life. Sometimes you might need to show up and be a little bit more strict on yourself. Sometimes you might need to cut yourself some more slack. But to just really listen to the creative process, to have fun,
right?
To not take it too seriously, to allow yourself to take risks and make mistakes, because mistakes really just are doors flung open that you wouldn't have otherwise opened. Mm. So sometimes it's just a matter of flinging that door open and looking through it and saying, that's interesting. Back in the other direction again. Or sometimes that actually might be a whole new vista that you couldn't have imagined otherwise. So really staying curious, I think, is the biggest blessing around the creative process. Just being curious and playful and paying attention. For years, I had the intention. I hosted New Moon Circles every month, and we would set intentions every month. And for 5 years, my intention was spaciousness, because I just had this like concept. It was like this fantasy of like, one day I won't have a pile of laundry and backed up email list, and I'll have all the hours in the day, and like, I'll be able to like finally breathe. But I realized that as a creative being and as a self-employed artist and business person and event producer and like somebody that's just constantly putting things on their plate, it's just never going to happen.
Right.
I don't want it to happen because my life is full of amazing things that I put there, that I like constantly am filling my plate with amazing things. I'm so grateful.
Yeah.
And so instead, now I've shifted my intention from spaciousness to savoring. Mm. So the intention of savoring is something that will serve you very well in the creative process, whatever that is, whether that's just simply the creative process of living, of life, of just really paying attention to little moments, you know, really paying attention to how that crayon feels on the surface of the cardboard, or how the onions sing in the frying pan, or the smell of the moss when you walk into the forest, or, you know, just that little moment in between brush strokes when you're wetting your brush on the palette, and how pretty the colors are as they all bleed together. Really just paying attention to those little moments, I believe, is what creates spaciousness in the everyday, in the creative process, in our very busy lives that are very full of social media, that are very full of to-do lists and unanswered emails and family demands and all the things. We can create spaciousness in our body, in our practice, in our hearts and minds and playfulness, just by being aware of, like, the way that the light glints off the side of the buildings as the sun sets over the beautiful city of Vancouver, or, you know, like footsteps of other creative people going down the hallway. It's like those spaciousness moments happen a lot, and they are there if we notice them. Otherwise they cruise on by, and then, you know, we're 80.
Right. And we haven't savored any of it. Then we want to savor all of it.
Yeah.
Wow.
So we don't want to jump to the end. So often people, like, they don't realize, a common theme when I'm teaching art is people realizing how long it takes to make a painting. Like, I paint in the style of magic realism. So if you're painting in the style of realism with sort of imagination mixed in, that's what magic realism would be, or visionary art, it takes a long time. It's like, if you're painting a wolf, you have to paint every brush stroke of that fur. It takes a long time. And so people realize, it's like this common theme of realizing that, wow, this is a long process. Like, I really just need to learn patience, and it teaches you patience. Mm-hmm. And so how can you enjoy that process? Because if we're thinking of it metaphorically, of this painting as a metaphor for my life, why would I want to jump to the punchline?
Yeah.
Wouldn't I want to just enjoy every brushstroke of fur? Like, every moment, every day? You know, it's not the weekend yet. Oh, okay. So how can you find spaciousness and play, the spirit of the weekend, if you're working a 9-to-5 job? How can you find that in your lunch hour, or in your conversation around the water filter? Or like, how can we just savor and just enjoy? Because what a blessing every moment is. What a blessing every brushstroke is. I don't want to jump to the punchline.
Yeah, in our launching of our book, I was like, I can't wait till the launch is done. And my friend was like, what? Like, no, don't jump there. Like, this is the richness, the celebration as you prepare, as you get going. And I was like, thank you.
Yeah, ripening.
Yeah, exactly. God, what a beautiful conversation. So much more than, quote unquote, the conversation of art.
But were we supposed to talk about art
of
more?
Living. Right, right. We did. Thank you so much. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Mark. Likewise. Thank you for the work you do in the world. And I'm honored to be here with you, and excited for a new friendship.
Me as well. And we'll make sure in the show notes is especially that video of the veil being painted and revealed again, and all the things that Autumn Sky shared. And subscribe and stay tuned. More coming.